Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that isn't crying. You're crying. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
Also with us, his hair is part of the red wall, is Councillor John Cotton.
Hello.
He's got more banter than John Ashworth, it's Luke John Davis.
Hello.
And you'll never find her hiding in from reporters in the fridge, it's Bridget Jones.
Hello.
Is that because she keeps her cool?
No, because surely she'd keep her cool if she was... Anyway... This election's all been about inappropriate food metaphors, really. And food appliances in particular.
I was going to say, is this intro oven ready?
It is oven ready.
Some people got
which
blended.
Means I'm not going to put it in the microwave because that would be ridiculous for us. Anyway, right, so in this episode, we're going to talk about the result of the general election. And incredibly, we're going to do it sober. Most of us anyway, RJ.
You speak for yourself.
Let's start with the biggest losers of the night. Incredibly, they lost MPs. They staked everything on stopping Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. And now find themselves in an existential crisis. And their leader lost their seat. It was a bad night for Labour, but it was a terrible night for the DUP. With the Conservatives. So despite hiding in the fridge and using, frankly, illogical oven-based metaphors, Boris Johnson has a majority of 80. So 44% of the votes, 1.2% up, I think slightly up on 2017, 365 seats. John, how did the Tories keep their voting coalition together?
Well, this is just an extraordinary result, isn't it? Because I was thinking about this. The last time the Tories pulled off something like this, I was 13 years old. So that's a very, very long time ago. But it does show the scale of what they've done here. And it creates, I think, some really big challenges for them. Where they've made those gains, the so-called red wall. And I think there are some myths, actually, about the red wall as been described. If you go back to those period in the 80s I was talking about, a number of those seats were actually very close at that point. Labour at the time was holding them by majorities of, you know, 1,000 or 2,000. So a myth has grown up that these are great bastions of Labour support with huge majorities throughout their existence. I don't think that's the case. But clearly they've broken through in a way that they didn't in the 1980s. But I think they now have some real issues about how they honour some of the promises that they've made in order to break through into those seats. Clearly this is a move away from the policies they were adopting around a very sort of neoliberal approach, a pre-market based approach, the economics of austerity and cutting public services. They have effectively run on a ticket that's against some of those things that they were previously expounding and implementing in government. Now they've got a challenge about how they deliver on that. And when you then look at some of the spending commitments that they've made and marry them up against the tax cutting commitments they've made, I'm not sure how they pay for this. There are billions that they're promising to put into NHS and other services at the same time as cutting taxes. So I think this becomes a very difficult thing for them to navigate. So they may have... this could be a victory that turns to ashes for them quite quickly. And then when you factor in the impact of Brexit as well, and the fact that despite the rhetoric around we're going to get Brexit done, clearly this is a psychodrama that will run and run for some time post any exit, immediate exit from the European Union, I think they've stored up a number of problems. And how they hold that coalition together, I think, is going to be really challenging for them.
So I'd entirely agree with that. What we all learnt from the doorsteps in our very, very wet and cold campaign was the two biggest reasons people were switching from Labour to Tories were Brexit and Jeremy Corbyn. And they picked up an awful lot of votes because of those two things. But both of those are temporary states. Jeremy Corbyn is standing down as leader. Brexit, we all hope, well, it's hard to believe sometimes, will be resolved at some point. And it looks like we will be leaving the EU within about 6 weeks, which is quite terrifying to say out loud. how they keep the confidence of those people once those two temporary things are no longer wedge issues is a trick that they've got to pull off. You know, public spending, as John has said, their commitments are extraordinary and not like any Tory government we've seen previously, whether they can pull that off, whether they can maintain the confidence of those people and find other things to keep them hooked in is what will define whether they succeed and whether they get in again.
So I spent the election in Stoke North, obviously, which is part of the red wall that fell, and my experience was that Brexit came up on the doorstep at about one in three doors. The NHS came up a fairly similar amount. People were worried about the health service. What came up on every single doorstep was Jeremy Corbyn.
Was that you bringing it up?
No.
Or was that...
No, it wasn't. I mean, one of the things about Stoke, which is perhaps different to other places, it does have a high percentage of veterans. A lot of what Brexit did wasn't so much any details about Brexit itself. It was two things. One, it fed into a sense of Jeremy Corbyn in particular, rather than the Labour Party, but the people around Corbyn as well, of being anti-British. Now, with the high number of veterans there, you had a lot of people who had been stationed in Northern Ireland, and, you know, were, having been shot at by the IRA, were not particularly enamoured of his stance on that. Brexit also played into that. His reaction to the Salisbury poisonings played into that. People still remembered 2015 when he refused to sing the national anthem. People had a sense that Jeremy Corbyn was anti-British, did not believe in Britain in whatever way you want to say that, or was anti-patriotic. That was a huge issue there. I think the other thing that Brexit did was it was a cultural marker, and it was a sense that London politicians, which Labour was now defined as, did not understand the culture of Stoke and places like Stoke, and that Boris Johnson did in a different way.
Which is quite remarkable on its own.
Yes, it is. It really is. That will slip, because I don't think Boris Johnson can necessarily keep that going. But what this means is that the Tories are now copying the Republican playbook, US Republicans playbook. Now, what they do, the US Republicans have managed to establish a coalition of super rich and big business with less affluent areas, the Rust Belt areas. And the way they've done that is by focusing on cultural issues, even before Trump. Trump is obviously the biggest manifestation of this. And occasional splurges of funding, of spending on, I mean, you know, this is where Johnson's tax cuts, but also, you know, 50,000 nurses, which is actually 31,000 nurses or however, you know, but this is where those things come in, paid for by high borrowing on the, in the state's safe assumption, that if there is high borrowing and high deficits, the general public will blame the left-wing party, not the right-wing party, regardless of who actually ran up those deficits. And this is clearly, Johnson has played the Republican playbook on this issue. The fact that we've sat and talked about Jeremy Corbyn in the section on the Conservatives is telling.
Well, yes, my red wall crumbled, because the whole point of starting this podcast with the Conservatives was that we could maybe not start.
But I think that's the reason, and I think that's also the reason why Boris Johnson refused to do things like the Andrew Neil interview and so on, because their biggest election asset was Jeremy Corbyn. This was a Labour loss, not a Conservative win, for those red wall seats.
Yeah, and I think there's actually that last point in particular is quite pertinent, because when you look at a lot of the various bits of data that have come out since the election, granted we're still relatively early days, but there's still polls and focus groups and all kinds of things which come out. The reality is the British population, and this goes to those red wall seats as well, they don't like Boris Johnson, but they just didn't like Jeremy Corbyn more. For whatever reason, it might, you know, they thought that Johnson was a better choice. But even then, they don't trust him, they don't like him. You have situations where there's been some vox pops and things of people in these red wall seats who are, you know, lifetime Labour voters, basically saying, I don't want to vote Conservative, but I've had to vote Conservative this time. we'll see what he does. And so John's point about kind of like holding on to those people is very pertinent. This is not necessarily a kind of a grand realignment in the sense of everything is kind of shifted. The grasp that the Conservatives have on those voters is flimsy at the moment. And if they're not careful, they can fall right away. Now, whether they fall back to Labour or just fall out of the turnout figures in totality is a separate question, and dependent on exactly what Labour does, what the Tories do, and all kinds of different things. The Tories' kind of like red wall strategy was successful just because, for the time being, people have been willing to go, okay, let's see what you can do, and we don't want to talk about Brexit, and this seems like to be the best way to quickly get this done.
There's a danger in this of just over-interpreting this as some sort of historic break. It is a defining moment, there's no doubt about that. But if you take a longer perspective on this, some of this is just a kind of return to form that we've seen before. As I said, you know, a number of those seats that were painted as part of the Red Wall have traditionally been quite marginal in the past. There's always been a strong strain of working class conservatism, or tendency amongst working class voters to vote conservative. I mean, when I first got involved in politics in Birmingham, half of the seats in this city were represented by conservative MPs. So the whole idea of that there's been sort of like massively red seats and with huge majorities is relatively recent in that sense. But it does, as you say, come back to that fundamental issue the Tories now have, which is how do we hold on to those seats? And what does that then do to the nature of us as a party, with where we've been traditionally being in terms of free market economics and so on? They've got a real problem here. I'm not sure how they work that one through.
Yeah, especially when you consider some of the size of the majorities of the seats that they've picked up. So let's use just like a local example here of Birmingham Northfield. Richard Burden lost that seat to Gary Sandbrook on, I believe it was about 1,000 votes.
1,500
votes. So that's not a lot. That means it's still a marginal. And a lot of those seats that the Tories picked up are within those kind of boundaries of still being marginals. This, as I said, it's not a grand realignment where swathes upon swathes of these people in these Red Wall seats have switched over to the Tories. Well, it's just enough of them have for the time being.
It's more, I think what happened is the Tories kept their voting coalition from 2017 together.
Yeah.
Is what's happened. And part of that, I think, is that message, get Brexit done, definitely cut through. I heard that on the doorsteps a few times. Are there any Conservative leavers from 2017 still voted Conservative? But also, that we talked a little bit, Steve, about those Conservative Remainers, and the Conservatives won 2/3 of their Conservative Remain voters. And they were always going to be a really, really important chunk of people, not just in Labour seats, but also in Lib Dem, Tory marginals as well. And the fact that they stuck with the Tories and didn't go Lib Dem, I think, is very significant. And so the Tories kept their voting coalition and ours fell massively away. So the seat that I was most involved with, or the marginal seat I was most involved with, was Wolverhampton North East, which was Emma Reynolds and now is Conservative. Now, and that's for the first time since 1987. So you alluded to the Thatcher landslide. Well, this is one that's come back. And in 2017... Labour got about 19,000 votes, though the Tories got 15,000, so it's about 4,500 Labour majority. This time, Labour got 13,000 votes, and the Tories got 17,000. So the Tories only put on an extra 2,000, but we've lost 6,000 votes. Now, only a few of them, therefore, are Tory switchers. Turnout was slightly down this time than 2017. So my assumption is a lot of our vote didn't turn out and vote. For one reason or another, and again we lost some to the Brexit Party, probably some to the Lib Dems and some to the Greens.
Yeah, on the Brexit Party note is quite an interesting thing, because there's been some top level analysis that's kind of happened already, and what they basically found is that the Brexit Party obviously did not do particularly well at all in terms of vote share. There was never really a risk of them getting a seat, but they didn't do particularly well in vote share either, because it looks like all of their votes siphoned back off to the Conservatives.
Although there were a couple of seats up north where the Brexit Party actually came second, and if you add together the Brexit Party plus the Conservative vote, that added together would have been a very big majority in those seats. So if the Brexit Party hadn't stood at all, I think we'd have seen an even bigger Tory landslide.
Yeah, Gower was one of those seats where Brexit Party's strength, higher than usual, actually saved it for Labour. I'm sure there's others.
Barnsley as well. So I think Dan Jarvis only won by about 2,000 votes from the Brexit Party.
I think somebody said that Ed Miliband's seat was very similar as well.
Yeah, yeah. About 2,000 votes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually in Stoke North weren't actually that far off the figures that we thought we'd get out for Labour. One of the things that I think feeds into what I think Steve was saying about some of our vote just stayed at home, quite a lot of it I think did. And I also think when all the sort of data is crunched, we'll see a lot of people who voted twice, once in the Brexit referendum and once now, and who may not have voted in 2017 at all, and who pushed the Tories over the edge. And one thing that was ignored or not really discussed, well, I certainly talked about it, but it was certainly not discussed at the head of level at the top of the party.
Do you not have those connections with the top of the Labour Party at the moment, LJ?
I do not know. Was that Theresa May was actually very, very successful in knocking a huge swathe of Labour seats into marginal territory. And as you say, the Tories have actually only put on a couple of percent nationally. What's happened is Labour's dropped away massively. That drop away, I think, is actually what's cost us these seats.
And just moving on slightly to Labour and the Corbyn question, I think the more interesting thing maybe to talk about is the different demographics of the attitude to Jeremy Corbyn. So if you look at, certainly anecdotally, I mean, we've talked about this before we're recording and we'll talk about it now, but it was generally an issue with men, is what we found anecdotally. And that's borne out in, certainly in Lord Ashcroft's polling. He did an exit poll. Men were backing the Tories 48-29 for Labour, whereas in the women's just a 6-point lead, so 42-36, which I think is kind of interesting, and especially kind of older men, I suppose, 40-65. Mm. Whereas actually Labour's getting 57% of the vote, 18-24, 55% of the vote, 25-34. Like, a lot of that voting coalition from 2017 was still there, but it fell back in a lot of these other seats that the Tories then picked up. And that was May's strategy, wasn't it, back in 2017, which she assumed these were in play. And there was that Nick Timothy with the Erdington Conservatism. Like, their play was to try and get these Labour seats. But this time, it was a much more managed Tory campaign. The manifesto didn't have any details in it. There were no screw-ups like the reintroducing fox hunting or ivory or any of those really shareable issues that we talked about already, haven't we, Steve, yeah, on other podcasts.
There's an independent poll, a public poll published this morning in The Independent, that for every voter that Labour lost because of Brexit, they lost two because of Jeremy Corbyn.
There's a few outriders trying to make the conversation about saying this was a Brexit election, it was a rerun of the referendum, which I don't think is quite true. When you look at the polling of why are people voting why they are, actually, most Tory voters, yes, OK, they're voting to get Brexit done, in their phrase. But actually, there was other polling that YouGov have done of Labour leavers that say actually the fact that Labour was promising another referendum was third on their list, and the top of the list was they didn't want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. And we can argue whether or not that's down to the structural bias of the media. We can argue about lots of different things, but the fact is it was an issue.
I could not tell you what Labour's core message was that we were supposed to be hammering home that last week. What was the priority?
Hashtag stick with Steve.
Well, it was a message. Yeah. Well, so John McDonnell was asked that and said it was a message of hope.
But that doesn't mean anything. And also,
well, it doesn't now, LJ, because we're very depressed after that. what hope is in the future, you think that things might be all right. You think things can only get better.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm saying. But, and that, in many ways, was a message of hope. We need to go back. Yeah. No, we don't need to go back to those days.
But on that,
let's go forward.
Yes,
go back.
On
the issue that Labour's got in this, and all social democratic parties, I think, have got a similar issue to Labour, I suppose, is that your voting coalition is made of the essentially the working class and the liberal intelligentsia. And that's been fracturing across Europe and across America as well. And a lot in the party have been arguing is that it's the radicalness of the Labour message, especially in 2017, which has kept that coalition together, when perhaps actually it's a combination of Brexit and our voting system. And in this one, our stupid voting system actually hasn't helped, and now I have lots of hands up.
Our message was a huge amount about reforming structures. So I've had the motto ever since my days in student politics, where I saw a tremendous number of people pour so a tremendous amount of time into changing structures. My motto has always been change lives, not structures. And having policies like public ownership services and so on aren't inherently bad things. Mm. However, changing structures does not necessarily lead to changing lives. And we banged on about structural change without really translating that into what it might mean for a difference in somebody's living standard. I think you should only change structures if it will actually translate into a change in people's lives, be that through whatever route. But also, somebody made this argument to me the other day, and I thought it was quite a good one. Under Blair, we did quite a lot to reform the living standards of people, and the country quite fundamentally changed, whether that's directly because of Blair or just the times it was in. It's a combination of both. But the working classes don't exist as they did pre, you know, back in the 80s. We have catered our manifesto this time towards this notional idea of what the working class is and who they are, which just doesn't exist anymore. The country has moved on, largely, but for some reason we have leapt backwards as a party in terms of who we're targeting.
So I completely disagree with you on one bit, that I do not think that manifesto was in any way targeted at the working class. That manifesto was targeted at the middle class. If you look at rail commuters, for example, there's 11% of the country commutes by rail, and they are overwhelmingly more affluent than rail road users. 68% of the country commutes by road, whether that's car or bus commuting, and they are overwhelmingly poorer, particularly those on buses. Middle class issue is, railways is the middle class issue. You also have tuition fees, overwhelmingly middle class, more affluent issue. That is, a scrapping tuition fees and keeping welfare cuts, as in 2017, as in 2019, was a straight transfer of wealth from the poorest to the middle class. That manifesto was targeted at the middle class. There is a real issue here in that I think London is now a separate election, like Scotland has been for a while. And I think certainly the last two elections, 2017, 2019, London has been a separate election. And this was a London Labour Party, right? Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, Diane Abbott, Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry, they are all London-based. They all live in that bubble. And they try to put together the Obama coalition, which works in London because you have a high number of ethnic minority voters and a high number of what in America is called white college educated voters. That does not work across the country. It simply doesn't translate. And one of the reasons, there's various reasons. One is that in this country, if you get a college, university degree, sorry, you end up in a metropolitan area because those jobs do not exist in places like Stoke. And also, if you look at the United States, their ethnic minority vote, whether it's African-Americans or Hispanic-Americans, is about 40% of the country. In the United Kingdom, at the last census, 89% of the UK was white British, 4% was white Irish. Overall, the attempt to impose a London strategy on the rest of the country is one of the main reasons why this failed.
So I think the kind of the main thing about everything you've just said is that it's kind of it is almost certainly kind of like a London-centric view, but it's almost like a London-centric view of what a struggling person looks like, because yes. That's the core thing.
That's what I was trying to get at.
They think they're addressing the working class, because actually you can be working class in London and still be what elsewhere is a middle class professional, because rents are so high, you can't get onto the property ladder, all of those different things, which in turn means that they go, these are the people that we can see, these are the struggles that we can see, let's do something about it. But the struggles down there are different to everywhere else, and they're not addressing the problems everywhere else.
And I think that what they see that outside London in terms of working class is the Durham Miners Gala, and they think that's what working class life is.
I think there's a real danger in this discussion that we, in kicking over the traces of what's just happened, and it's all very fresh, and you know, we're all quite bruised, I think, by it, is that we lose some of the wider perspective here. I think you can make a whole series of very valid criticisms of the leadership of the party in this election. And clearly that was a very strong issue that came across on the doorsteps. And anyone who's knocked a door can't deny that. I think clearly our position or confused position around Brexit was also an issue on the doorsteps. That's a fact. But the root of the disaffection that played out in us losing seats in that so-called Red Wall is not something that's just a result of those two recent factors. This has been unwind that's been happening for the last 15 years. And in the same way that you can make the accusation that Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott own Islington elites, that exact accusation could be levelled at Tony Blair and many of the new Labour leadership.
100%,
back 15 years. I think the issue is here that as we try and put things back together post this terrible defeat that we've had, we sort of focus on the immediate and we don't consider the fact that this has been unravelling for a long period. And until we get into some of those root cause issues and rebuild our relationship with those communities, which means a very different approach to that which we adopted either in New Labour or in more recent Labour terms, we're going to be creating back in the same situation in 4 or 5 years' time.
the manifesto and the policies themselves individually, yeah, I think you pulled pretty much all of them. Other than the broadband one, I think were just really, really popular. The broadband one was just a kind of, hey, what, where's that come from type policy. But the rest were kind of like traditional kind of like Labour left type
things. Individually
they were popular. But the issue is, and this kind of comes down to the planning around the campaign, the strategy, the communications, where rather than having that core message, which was just being hammered home, you just had a shopping list of policies which were being put out to people with no focus on prioritisation. And so you're just hoping that people will see enough things they like and go, yeah, I'll go for that. But the reality is, all people saw was something that seemed to be too good to be true. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the financials or whatever, most of it was deliverable in some form, but it's the timeline and the times and the scale it would take to deliver it. Because they're promising all of these things in 5 years, when in reality, some of these things are going to take 5, 10, potentially even 15 years to actually get into place and to get through all of it. And that's, I think, where the biggest issue comes down to. They failed to prioritise anything. They failed to build a campaign around those priorities, which in turn means no communications got through, which means that we became vulnerable to the Conservative narrative of, you know, you can't be trusted because they're just going to spend all this money.
I think the other thing is, people don't vote in elections generally based on policies. People vote, as we've talked about already, based on cultural reasons, say.
I think Steve's point about priorities is actually really valid. And I think one of the issues here is, like, what were the priorities? What were the top five things that you would have put on the back of a pledge card?
So if we move on to the real story of the night, which was the Lib Dems. Hello, Mark, by the way, and congratulations,
Mr. President.
And so if we're going to look at a positive night for the Lib Dems, you could say, well, they gained votes everywhere, which is why I'm not necessarily sure you can say that all Labour's problems were down to Brexit, because the Lib Dems were gaining votes in every region of the country.
Yeah, and we lost in every region of the country, including London.
Yeah, and there's the fallacy of, well, actually most Labour voters in these Labour seats voted Remain. But anyway, and actually there were many second places the Lib Dems got. So in terms of, there is definitely a base there. But we, Steve, talked about at the start of the campaign, it might end up in a kind of Clegg Mania cubed situation. That's kind of what happened, isn't it? The most shocking thing, when I rechecked, there was, I think I went to bed about 5 and then woke up again about 9 because I hate myself. And checked my phone, and I couldn't believe the Lib Dems hadn't won Sheffield Hallam, which is just insane. And so you just get the impression it's just such a problem with targeting there. The Lib Dems led on Swinson quite heavily, led on Revoke quite heavily, which didn't really help. Yeah. And they believed their hype in terms of the European elections and a lot of the constituency polling. But why was Revoke in this election so unpopular? When actually, when it was polled, it actually polled pretty well in November.
So I think there's several reasons here. So first of all, when you poll the concept of Revoke in a abstract sense, what people hear is, are you against Brexit? And they will go, yes, I'm against Brexit. As interpreted via this question of, yes, I support Revoke. When it comes to actually making a decision, they start to think about it. This is the point where Corey spits out his tea, because I'm going to repeat Ken Clark's point from earlier in this week, which was, I think was also discussed on one of the Talking Politics podcasts that came out recently, which is that the beauty of the first-past-the-post system...
Get out.
I told you this is where he spits out his tea. The beauty of the first-past-the-post system is it forces the electorate as much as politicians to face fundamental issues. And when it came down to it, people did not feel that they could actually do something as undemocratic as Revoke. I think the second issue that Revoke caused the Liberal Democrats is it highlighted Brexit too much. And the reason I say that is this. The seats that the Liberal Democrats had to win had to be won off the Conservatives. And they had to take a stance on that, which to win Conservative Remainers. Now, what they had to take was a pro-Remain stance and an anti-Corbyn stance. Because they were very obviously not going to win a majority, the fact that people thought that their priority was stopping Brexit and not stopping Corbyn meant that Conservative Remainers didn't feel confident enough to vote for the Liberal Democrats, because they thought that would end up getting Corbyn. That is what I think has cost them a lot of these seats in the southwest, certainly.
Interesting take, which was, I think it was from Nick Tyrone, who is a Lib Dem blogger and member. And one of the things he put out about Revoke I found quite interesting was that he basically said they didn't actually own the policy It wasn't necessarily the right policy, but they ran away from it anyway because they kind of realised it. So what happened was the revoke came up as a kind of point of discussion, and all the talking heads from the Lib Dems kind of just said, oh, yes, but that's only if we get a majority, which we know we're not actually going to get. So we're actually just the People's Vote Party, which in turn moved the kind of the debate back to the People's Vote and lessened the difference between the Lib Dems and Labour, which meant they could lose what Remainers felt they were more open. It was better for them to go, well, it kind of gave them permission almost to go back to Labour. And as a result of that kind of not going all in for a full-throated support of revoke, what they also failed to do was highlight the fact that this is a revoke is the quickest, simplest way to end this debate on Brexit. And I think on the revoke level, that's kind of, to me, the most interesting kind of dynamic there, is that there was a potentially another way they could have approached it. It may not have worked. But,
well, I suppose, for instance, like in the debate was, it was episode one of a 10-season box set.
I think there's two other things we haven't talked about. So there's the failure of the Remain Alliance, which failed because Labour weren't part of it. Two reasons we weren't part of it, I think. One is, obviously, we ceded quite a few MPs to the Lib Dems, so it's tricky to then go into an arrangement with them. Second of all, we decided our position on Brexit about 5 minutes ago, which didn't help. I think we've got actually the most sensible policy on Brexit going, the idea of negotiating a new deal and putting that to a second referendum. But because we decided on that so extraordinarily late in the day, nobody was listening by then and nobody cared. Second thing is we need to talk about Jo. So yeah. I really like Jo Swinson and I feel really sorry for her, actually. She feels like a politician from 10 years ago. She's sort of in that Blairite mode of quite polished, quite reserved, quite set PC, and the sort of mood has moved on from then. It almost feels like she's arrived 10 years too late to me. I've got a lot of time for her, I have to say, but she didn't have time to warm up into the role. She became leader very quickly before the general election, and when you're plunged into something at the deep end like that, you know, as I was in children's services a few years ago, it can take a while to find your feet and warm up and, you know, find your voice in that, which I don't think she had time to do. But yeah, also she did feel like a politician from 10 years ago rather than one from today.
I think the other really interesting fact here is just the re-emergence of genuine two-party politics as a feature of our system in a way that we've not seen for a number of years. And I think that's why, whilst Labour has some real difficulties to address as a result of this defeat that we've been through, I think the position for the Liberal Democrats is even more challenging because what is... I say this in the nicest possible way, what is the point of them in the politics that we are now in? I think they're really struggling to find any distinct role within that system. Yeah. And I also think, you know, there is an issue around leadership, and I again have some sympathy for what's happened to Jo Swinson. But unless you've got somebody with some real punch and weight, and I think the only two Liberal Democrat leaders I can think of really achieved this were Paddy Ashdown and Charles Kennedy. And both of them were able to sort of like lead a charge over very distinct issues and do that in quite a coherent way, which the current Liberal Democrats have failed to do over the Brexit situation. I think they are in a real difficulty here. I'm struggling to see what the future is for the Lib Dems at the moment.
It would be interesting to know if people like Chuck Ramana and Sam Giamat, if those MPs had actually fought seats in the South West for the Lib Dems, had made pretty strong gains for local elections, I can see that might have worked really well. Whereas as it was, the kind of campaign we had in which Labour were getting angry with the Lib Dems at splitting the vote in London marginals like Kensington and Westminster, and the Lib Dems were getting angry with Labour for splitting the vote in places like Wimbledon, I think it's partly a symptom of both sides have been chucking mud at each other over Brexit for the last year or two. And so I wonder if you've got a situation where actually a lot of Lib Dems were quite happy to vote tactically for Labour in a lot of seats, but maybe not enough Labour people in London were willing to vote tactically for Lib Dems. And I think the Lib Dems assumed, and actually a lot of polling at the start of the campaign saw Lib Dem surges in London, which then snapped back to Labour. Whereas actually, if the Lib Dems are trying to hit those kind of core seats in the South West and put the defectors in there, that might have made more of a difference, possibly.
Yeah, so I think the kind of like the positioning of the defectors is quite an interesting one, because I think in any other political party, you know, Labour would have found a way to get them into more targeted seats. The Tories would have just enforced them onto the local parties in some form. But the Lib Dems, you know, in most instances, quite a positive commitment to internal democracy, giving local parties power over selections and things like that, meant that actually for most of those the seats that were already potential targets to be picked up, they had already selected people and they did not want to actually say, sorry, we're kicking you out so that you can have Chuka Umunna. When Chuka first made the jump, there was all kinds of rumours that he might take Vince Cable's old seat. He didn't. He ended up in, was it the City of Westminster seat? And it's like...
City of London and Westminster.
Yeah, City of London and Westminster, which is a very different seat. It's not as likely to go Lib Dem. And it just seems like that commitment to the internal democracy, laudable as though it may be, has kind of hurt them in that regard, because they've lost a lot of potential candidates that could have been the front line of the piece.
Basically the opposite of our problem.
Just very quickly, the one exception was Luciana, because it did make sense to run Luciana in Finchley Gardens Green, and I think that was an important and powerful statement.
Yeah.
Yes, because we haven't talked about anti-Semitism very much, but again, that was part of the general miasma of everything.
Yes, it was.
If we finish off, we're thinking about what this means for Britain.
And emigrating to Tahiti.
We haven't talked much about the results in Northern Ireland, about the result in Scotland and the possible breakup of the Union. We can talk about that in next week's show. I don't really necessarily want to talk about Brexit very much, because I have a feeling Steve will probably talk about that quite a bit in 2020. So let's just leave that for a happier time.
No, it's all going to be done, sorted, ended. Apparently.
Oven cooked.
But microwave ready.
I think it's going to be quite cold in the middle, though.
Well, that's what you got to defrost it first. So,
how much time is it ready?
Did Boris take it into the fridge with him?
The question at the start of the show, then, about how the Tories' electoral coalition they put together, thinking about how they might keep that going into subsequent elections and try and hold some of these seats and make a proper realignment, presumably means they need to try and invest in public services, and they've said that they'll invest in public services. How sceptical are we of those commitments?
Firstly, it's a great leap to see people who've been the architects of austerity over the last 10 years suddenly turning into munificent spenders of public money on massive infrastructure projects and everything else. So I have some cynicism around that. A lot of this stuff has been focused on the very eye-catching, you know, we're going to put so many billion into the NHS, but doesn't actually reflect the need to invest massively in local government services, which have really borne the brunt of the spending cuts and are actually the services that most directly affect the lives of a whole series of people within the population. So... yeah, I'll wait for the cheque to arrive from Whitehall to address that.
It doesn't go personally, John.
Does it not?
No.
That's where I've been going wrong. Damn. Also, sat alongside that, there's a whole set of spending commitments that have been made, but also a whole set of commitments sitting alongside it to tax cuts. And I'm not sure how this stacks up financially. I don't see how you can do both, particularly as we may be heading into a significant economic shock as a result of whatever happens with Brexit.
It's shocking that a political party would go into an election with spending plans that just don't add up.
Yeah. But I think in some respects, this also depends on Labour's choices. As I said before, you know, the what the Tories are doing is the Republican playbook here, which is the cultural issues to bring in the less affluent and then tax cuts for the more affluent. And I think that works as long as Labour continues to hew towards where the Democrats are in the US, which is this more metropolitan, individualised, atomised approach, which is progressively liberal rather than social democratic. And that covers both the Corbyn era and the Blair era. You know, both of those, for different reasons, are focused on liberal individualism rather than, and in different ways, rather than collective communitarian responses. And I think that actually is one of the key driver around this. So although some of it is definitely economics, I think on those cultural barriers, Labour has the choice to try and bring those back with things like progressive notions of patriotism. It's up to the Labour membership, which is overwhelmingly metropolitan.
Speak for yourself.
And, you know, well, like the US Democrats are. So, you know, if Labour continues to indulge that...
He's eating hummus while he's saying this. I'll just put that out, listeners.
No.
From the jar.
I'm really...
with his bare hands.
Like a bear and honey.
At least you didn't say avocado. I think avocado was green mush. I hated.
Steve at the moment is dipping an avocado in his hummus.
I refuse to say the word quinoa properly just because it annoys people.
Boxes of it here in the bunker.
this is a long-term cultural shift in the Labour Party. And I think we need to reverse that and go back to more John Smith era notions before we will start to see a significant clawing back of these red wall states. And this is an existential issue for the Labour Party. Who is it the Labour Party represents?
We represent the many, not the few. And on that note,
we clearly don't. I've got the election result to prove it.
Shall we finish there?
Yeah.
I think we've done all right.
Yeah.
None of us cried. We have a website, notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Twitter handles @NoChampagnePod.
@BridgetJones.
@CouncillorJohnCotton.
@LJDLabour.
@AcousticRadical. I'm on Twitter then.
And I'm @PaperbackWriter. Happy plotting.
You say responsible for our theme tune as though it's a crime that's been perpetrated.
Because you never say designed. I'm not sure.
Composed.
Composed would be the word to go with.
Of course it would.
Oh yeah.
But I'll do that in the quiz.
Every time you say LJD Labour, I think you're about to say El Diablo.
I mean, I can be devilish on Twitter.
Let's not go there. It's still recording.
Oh yeah.
I should stop that.